Okay, thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be addressing you all by Skype. It would beat the even worse jet lag that I'd experienced if I was there. I'm going to tell you about a review article that I wrote this January, which is based on two papers that I wrote with Stanley Deser and one paper with Cedric Defayette. And we can now switch to slide number two. The problem is one that's familiar to everybody for the last 15 years or so, and that's what's making the universe accelerate. And just in case it isn't familiar, let's look at it in the context of a homogeneous, isotropic, and spatially flat universe, which the geometry of which describes our universe on the very largest scales of 100 megaparsecs and bigger. And as you all know, the invariant element is minus dt squared plus a squared times dx dot dx. A is called the scale factor, and derivatives of it have been measured. One derivative, the logarithmic derivative, is the Hubble parameter. Its current value, as you know, is about 67 kilometers per second per megaparsec, or if we were to convert that to a pure frequency, since megaparsecs is a unit of distance, it would be about, about 3 times 10 to the minus 18 seconds. The other derivative that's measured is the so-called, the inappropriately named deceleration parameter, which Q of t, which is minus 1 minus h dot over h squared. And it's inappropriately called because since 1998, we've known that its value, instead of being positive, is actually negative. Its measured value is about minus 0.54. And anything less than zero means that the universe is accelerating rather than decelerating. And the problem, it's a big challenge to fundamental theory to try and understand what's causing this. There are plenty of explanations that are completely consistent with the data. If you take general relativity and convert from coordinates to a redshift in the usual way, that is a zero over a is one plus z, the redshift, then two of the Einstein equations are non-trivial. The G00 component, the so-called Friedmann equation, reads 3h squared is equal to that junk. And the trace of the GIJ equation reads minus 2h dot minus 3h squared is equal to that stuff. And the stuff that I put in there is a universe constructed out of radiation, matter, and a cosmological constant. That's the so-called lambda CDM model, and that'll work, provided that you take the values radiation, matter, and omega lambda that are given. But it's not really very satisfactory to, so it agrees with the data. Let me admit that straight off. It's not very satisfactory to fundamental theorists because it would correspond to a cosmological constant lambda such that G lambda would be a very, very small number, about 10 to the minus 122, but not 123, and that's a very important difference because that means that it's right about now that the universe comes to be vacuum energy dominated, as you can see, because omega lambda is the biggest portion of the stress energy or of the energy density of the universe. And that's called the cosmic, so the first thing why G lambda is so small is called the old problem of the cosmological constant, and why it's dominant right now is called the new problem of the cosmological constant. Is that Ted?
Yes.
Hey, Ted, long time no see. I didn't know you were at Perimeter.
Hi, Richard. I'm here for
Is that John?
Yes.
Hey, John. Wow. Old home day.
I call my non-local collaborator.
Yes, it's true. Okay, so we're ready to switch to slide three. So I just said that I gave the obligatory statement that lambda CDM works. Of course, you could have, you could just invent a new kind of energy density, stress energy density, which is not exactly a cosmological constant, but of course close to agree with the data. And that's called scalar quintessence. The simplest version of it would just be a minimally coupled scalar with a potential. And you can get that to agree with the data. And that actually allows me to make a very important point about a feature in this business called reconstruction. So let's take the two Einstein equations, the two non-trivial Einstein equations, and specialize them to that scalar stress energy, where I'll take, if I assume that the scalar is homogeneous, that is independent of space and only dependent on time, instead of calling it script phi, I'll call it F, F of T, okay? So when I specialize to that, these two equations become the thing up on the board. And the way one usually plays the game, if a traveling quantum field theory salesman comes along and says, hey, I've got this great V of phi, you know, and you should buy my quantum field theory and give me a Nobel Prize. The way one usually plays that game is that he specifies the V, and then you try and solve those equations and figure out how close the expansion history, that is A of T, is to the measured expansion history. But for reconstruction, which is an important feature of any of these models, you turn that game around and you play it the other way around. You say, suppose that A of T was the thing that was known. Suppose the expansion history was known. Has the model, whatever it is, in this case scalar quintessence, has it got enough freedom to reproduce that A of T? And the answer is yes, provided that the A of T corresponds to something that is obeying the weak energy condition, that is, provided that H is always decreasing, never increasing. And you can just prove that constructively, the best of all possible ways. So let's assume that A of T was known, and let's solve for what V would be necessary in order to support that particular expansion history. What you do first is to add together the two non-trivial Einstein equations. That gives minus 2h dot is equal to 8 pi g times the time derivative squared of the scalar. Now you see why it is that I wanted to assume that h was always decreasing. So that means that minus h dot is positive, and that means that you can take the square root of it. And, of course, the Friedmann equation is consistent. And then just by integration, you can solve for what the scalar is up to an initial value. And again, assuming that H is always decreasing, that solution is monotonic, either monotonic increasing if you chose the plus sign, and or monotonic decreasing if you chose the minus sign. It doesn't matter which. You can, if necessary, just graphically, just by taking the graph and flipping it over so that instead of reading what f is as a function of t, you read what t is as a function of f, that uniquely determines t as a function of f. And that's important for the final step of reconstruction, because that consists of just taking the second equation and subtracting it from the first and dividing by 2, so that you get 8 pi g times the potential is equal to this known function of time. But you also know what time is as a function of the scalar, so if you just plug that in, then you've got the potential. Okay, so that just proves constructively that scalar quintessence can certainly do it. So if somebody tells you, if the only thing they tell you is, I've got this model that reproduces the known expansion history, you just give them a mole, as they would say in Greek, because that's obvious. And in fact, you can give this closed form prescription for doing it. And of course, it also has some problems associated with it. First, why is the scalar field so homogeneous? You know, I've just by fiat said it independent of space, but in a real quantum field theory, it would be fluctuating in space as in time, and there's no real explanation for why it is that it's so small. Why is it that the scalar potential is so small? That is a reflection of the old problem of the cosmological constant. And a new feature here is this would have to be a pretty light scalar to do it. That potential would have to have a pretty small curvature, and that would be that would mean that there should be a fifth force, and we don't see any fifth force. So you've got some problems if you use scalar quintessence. It definitely can reproduce the expansion history, but it's got a few bad features associated with it. that make people believe that that probably isn't the right way to go. So we're ready to go to slide four now. That's where, instead of trying to add some new stress energy, you consider the other logical alternative, namely the left-hand side of the equation. You suppose maybe Einstein was not right about gravity. And you modify what gravity is. And the most popular version of that is what are called F of R models, where you take the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian, which is just R times the square root of minus G, and you change that to be a general function, F of R. It was a surprise to me to find out last year that those things don't really work. What I mean by that is that if you try and prove the reconstruction theorem, the result that you get is that there's only one solution for F of R which will exactly reproduce lambda CDM, and that is lambda CDM. So there isn't any new degree of freedom there. Of course, the data is not all that good, and there's certainly room for having things which aren't exactly lambda CDM and still have nonlinear dependence upon R. But what that means typically is that to the extent that lambda CDM is the expansion history you want, then deviations in F of R models are going to occur at zeroth order without even looking at perturbations. There are, of course, also other problems. R is dimensionful, and that means that you've introduced a new scale in order to get it to turn on at the right time. These models are higher derivative models, although not unstable necessarily, or at least they're not kinetically unstable, but they do have a new degree of freedom, and as in the scalar quintessence model, in order to get that to reproduce the expansion history, you're typically going to have that be a light degree of freedom, and that poses problems with why we don't see a fifth force. They're actually worse in the F of R model than in the scalar model, because in the scalar model you could by fiat say, well, it just doesn't couple to matter, and so it's only coupling gravitationally and we don't see it very well. But gravity, of course, couples to everything, and that's going to be sort of bad news for you. So again, I think even though there are passionate devotees of F of R models, I think a lot of people suspect that that probably isn't the way to go either. So we're ready to go now to slide five, and that deals with other modifications of gravity. So you could, of course, introduce other kinds of matter, and in fact, Ted is the author of a technique for doing that. So is John Moffat. So I won't attempt to bring coals to Newcastle about that. I will talk about just metric-based modifications of gravity. So no other fields than the metric, and the metric is the thing that carries the gravitational force. If you want to do that, you're in sort of a bind, because you can prove a theorem that F of R is the only local, invariant, and stable metric-based modification of gravity. So that means that you have to give up one of those things that we believe are pretty sacred. Research has been associated with giving up locality, retaining locality and sacrificing invariance, and that's Harava gravity, which was not, of course, introduced to explain acceleration, but rather to come up with a power counting renormalizable theory of gravity, and massive gravity, which many people are working on, are motivated to try and get a theory of acceleration, but also is a perfectly valid investigation just to see what are the possibilities that fundamental theory allows. The other possibility is that you could retain invariance and sacrifice locality, and that's the kind of model that I'm going to talk about. Been considered for summing quantum infrared effects from primordial inflation, for explaining late time acceleration without dark energy, and for explaining galactic structure without dark matter. I'm going to consider it for the second application, that is explaining late time acceleration without dark energy. And so we're ready now for the next slide, slide six. As soon as we imagine abandoning locality, we should, of course, do a reality check. And way, way back at the beginning of analytic physics, Isaac Newton vehemently denounced that sort of idea in his letters to Bentley in 1692, 1693. And I certainly take that criticism to heart. We're ready to go to slide 7 now. So I'm not going to say that Newton was wrong. I believe that fundamental theory is local, but I also believe that what we're living in is the quantum effective field equations rather than the operator Heisenberg equations. So those things are certainly not local. And in particular, there are massless particles, and massless particles, loops of massless particles, can give big infrared corrections. And infrared corrections is what we're looking for, because we're looking for some modification of the force of gravity on cosmological scales. Now, a lot of the older members of the audience remember Weinberg's, or at least are familiar with Weinberg's famous analysis of infrared corrections in quantum gravity with zero cosmological constant. And he found that there are significant infrared corrections, but they're not so important in terms of cosmology. That conclusion gets radically changed. That conclusion is basically because you have a dimension 5 coupling without a cosmological constant. If you have a, I should back up a moment and point out that, or remind you all that the biggest infrared effects are associated with massless particles, of course, and massless particles which interact through the lowest dimension coupling. So, for example, the huge infrared effects of quantum chromodynamics are associated with massless gluons which interact in a dimension 4 self-interaction. What Weinberg's result in 1965 was about the cosmological irrelevance of gravitons was associated with massless gravitons and a dimension 5 coupling, which makes them much weaker than QCD. But that conclusion is radically changed if you have a cosmological constant, because then there's a dimension 3 coupling. And that would mean, naively at least, you ought to have even stronger infrared effects than in quantum chromodynamics. And indeed, explicit calculations show that there's huge amounts of cosmological particle production associated with massless gravitons. So I give there the formula for the occupation number of one single mode, one single vector mode is growing exponentially. And of course, this is the source of the tensor power spectrum, which I hope that we'll see very soon. It doesn't just stop there. That's the primary effect. But of course, these gravitons, once they're produced, they interact with one another, and that will affect how it is that particles attempt to propagate through this mess of infrared gravitons, and it will also change the vacuum energy. It's been suggested by myself and Nick Tsamis that perhaps the mutual self-interaction of these gravitons will eventually stop inflation. You're free to believe that or not believe that, but I don't think we can be in any doubt about the sign, even though, regrettably, there are some people who do doubt the sign. Let's do an experiment here. Yes, gravity is still attractive. We can't doubt the sign. We could argue about how much it is, but it's certainly going to slow inflation a little bit. And whether or not slows inflation or not, these gravitons were produced, and so our universe really shouldn't be thought of as on the larger scales empty. It's actually living in a sea of very, very long wavelength gravitons. And that means that in terms of the effective field equations, we shouldn't imagine them to be governed by just Einstein's equations, but rather Einstein's equations with the gravitational vacuum polarization that would be associated with all this mess of long wavelength gravitons. That's, of course, just exactly what we want, because they're very long wavelength, they're cosmological scale gravitons, so they're going to affect large scales most, and that's what we want, because we don't see any deviations in the solar system. So that's my idea. That's the what a reporter would call deep background behind all of this. But for now, it's just model building. I don't have any way right now. I can calculate these things perturbatively and follow them perturbatively, but I don't have any way to look at what happens when they get to be strong. So I'm just attempting to model them by effective field theory, and you're free to disregard all the motivation and just regard it as a model building, just like F of R model building. So with that said, let's get to the model. That was suggested by myself and Stanley Deser. By the way, we're ready to go to slide 8, which reads late time acceleration. And that is the model that was suggested by myself and Stanley Deser in 2007. And we introduce a very simple type of non-locality through the inverse scalar D'Alembertian, which I give there as a function of the metric. And we're free to define the model. So we define inverse D'Alembertian with retarded boundary conditions. By the way, I should back up just a moment and say that even though you're free to ignore all my motivation about where it is that I think the non-local effects are coming from in these models, there are two important points that I need to make about that. The first is that if you do imagine these things as coming from quantum corrections to the effective field equations, quantum infrared corrections to the effective field equations, then there's a natural beginning of time associated with when you release the state, or in this case, when the infrared effects got to be non-perturbatively strong, roughly the end of inflation. And secondly, there are going to be features of these models that if you thought of them just from the context of phenomenology and just model building, you might say, gosh, you know, that seems like an unnecessarily restrictive set of assumptions, but there are features that come from this. For example, you would like only modifications on very large scales, and that will become important a little bit later in the talk. Okay, back to slide 8. So right off, the thing that reminded me that I needed to mention these two points was that that 1 over box needs boundary conditions, and I'll impose retarded boundary conditions. And again, you can see that this is not a fundamental theory, because fundamental theory shouldn't have a beginning of time. But in the context of effective field equations, no problem at all, they would have that. We defined the model as 1 over box acting on R, the Ricci scalar, just by simplicity. And that gives us a dimensionless quantity that we call capital X, which is 1 over box R defined with retarded boundary conditions. And our model could be thought of as just changing the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian from R square root of minus G to R times 1 plus F of X square root of minus G. And that's nice in the sense that we haven't introduced a new scale. This function f of x is called the non-local distortion function, and the effective field equations that you get associated with this are given below. And actually, I think the last line did not quite show up. That last term is 1 over box of r f prime of x. And that brings me to the first point that I'd like to make about these models, and that is how in the world you wind up getting field equations which are causal and conserved, which these are. And first off, by the way, we're ready to go to slide 9. First off, invariants, if you vary a generally coordinate invariant action, then you're going to get something conserved unless they change Noether's theorem. However, you would typically wind up getting something that would not be causal, in the sense that the effective field equations at time t would involve fields at times later than t, so it wouldn't be just in the past of t. And that's a bad thing if you want to try and evolve these things, and if you want to try and think about them physically. If you imagine physics as taking given initial value data and figuring out what's happening later on in time, that just precludes that. You can see why that's going on. You don't even have to do field theory. You can see it in the context of a non-local point particle model. So suppose that the dynamical variable is little q of t, and the action is a double integral, dt prime, q of t prime, dt double prime, q of double t double prime, times some Green's function, g of t prime and t double prime. And you might even assume that g is retarded, so that there's no dependence for t double primes that are later than t primes, but it doesn't make any difference. When you vary the thing with respect to q, you're going to get a contribution both from when the variation hits the q of t prime and also from when the variation hits the q of t double prime. One of them will give you an advanced Green's function and one of them will give you a retarded Green's function, and there you can see that you've just got a causality. So how is it that we avoid this while still preserving conservation? And the way that we do this is we don't just take the variation. We take the variation and then we just ad hoc, completely ad hoc, make a change in it. And the change is that we replace every advanced Green's function by a retarded Green's function. Now you might think, wait a minute, that's going to screw up conservation. But in fact, it doesn't screw up conservation because it turns out that all conservation needs is the differential equation that the Green's function obeys. It doesn't need the boundary conditions that they obey. And so you will wind up, if it was conserved before, it will still be conserved. And now the non-locality will be buried in the past rather than in the future. So you'll wind up with effective field equations which are both causal and conserved. And the ones that I gave on the previous slide do have that property. Now, of course, this partial integration trick is in no sense a derivation from fundamental theory. The way one would work in terms of fundamental theory is to do a hard calculation in quantum field theory using the Schwinger-Keldysh formalism, which involves two fields rather than one field. You vary with respect to one of the fields and then set the two fields equal after the variation, and that will produce causal and conserved effective field equations. But since I can't do that kind of a calculation yet, I can't sum up. I could do these things perturbatively, but then I only get very, very small effects. I can't sum up the small perturbative effects to get a big non-perturbative effect. I'm just treating this thing entirely phenomenologically. And since I am doing that, and I just want to have some effective field equations to study, I'll be totally unashamed with doing the partial integration trick and studying these effective field equations. Okay, so we're ready to move on to the next slide, which is specialization to Friedman, Roberts, and Walker. And I remind you what the elements, the invariant element is for that. And remember, our model involves two things. First, the Ricci scalar, which when you specialize it to Friedman, Roberts, and Walker is just 6h dot plus 12h squared, and 1 over box. And 1 over box on any function of just time can be written as a very, very simple double integral involving the scale factor. So even though you might think, gosh, this is going to be really complicated, it's not so bad when you write down what it is in a homogeneous and isotropic spatially flat background. You can also see why it is that this is potentially an interesting model as far as explaining the cosmological coincidence problem. And that is that it's got two, which is why it is that things are only happening very, very late in cosmological time. That is because it's got two built-in delays. Throughout most of logarithmic time history of the universe, it was in radiation domination. And radiation domination is very special. There, H would be 1 over 2 T if it's perfect radiation domination. And if you plug that in to this combination 6H dot plus 12H squared, you wind up getting just zero. R exactly vanishes during radiation domination. So 1 over box doesn't give anything until R makes the transition to matter domination. And that already delays you to very, very late in cosmological time. That delays you to about 100,000 years after the Big Bang. The second delay is that even when it does turn on, the thing that's turning on is not R, which immediately gets big, but rather 1 over box R. So it's got an integral, and that delays the turn on. And you can easily show that 1 over box R grows like logarithm of T over T equality, so that even by now, this quantity X is only about minus 15. So those two delays allow you to, in a, I would say, a pretty natural way, delay the onset of this thing until very, very late in cosmological history. So we're ready now for the next slide, which is called Reconstructing Lambda CDM. And that's based on a paper that Cedric Defayet and I did. So it turns out, if you recall the reconstruction, well, remember that the reconstruction problem is whenever a traveling quantum field theory salesman comes along and gives you some model, either with modified stress energy or modified gravity or both, and he wants to try and sell you that model, you want to check and see first that he can get the expansion history right. And so if it's got free parameters in it, you you say, okay, given A of T is lambda CDM or close to lambda CDM, can I choose the free parameters to do that? It's quite a bit harder to do that for this non-local cosmology model than it was for the scalar quintessence model that I showed you way back on slide 3, but it's doable. Cedric Defayet and I got a solution to it. And when you graph it, it's that graph shown on the slide. That's a numerical solution. If you ask, okay, is that, well, you can already see that it looks very, very much like an arctanh. If you look at it analytically, it's approximately 1/4 times tanh of a simple linear function of x minus 1. And on the curve, the little blue dots mark the redshifts where we are. So this would be to reproduce all of lambda CDM, that is, even in the infinite future. If you just want the part that that we're at, you would only go to z equals 0, which is about halfway down the tanh when it's making its transition from 0 to minus 1/2. So that's not a very weird function. That's a pretty simple function, and it looks like something that might conceivably actually have come from fundamental theory. So it's not a bizarre thing at all. We're ready for the next slide, which is entitled Screening. So you recall that that many of these models, in order to get the expansion history, they have to have light degrees of freedom that introduce new forces, and that's a problem because you don't want new forces inside the solar system where we've made precision tests. That's a terrible problem for F of R models. One way of saying it is that that R is positive both in the cosmological setting and inside the solar system, inside a gravitationally bound system. And that means that it's tough for F of R models to be able to know that they should do something for cosmology and still not do something for the solar system. And that means that you have to cook up intricate screening mechanisms in order to suppress deviations inside the solar system. Non-local cosmology completely avoids this problem. And the reason why is because it's not just based on R, which, remember, has the same sign both for cosmology and for a gravitationally bound system. It has an extra factor of 1 over box. And whereas R's got the same sign, box changes sign. Box, if you just looked at it in flat space, is minus dt squared, but plus del squared. That means that on cosmologically interesting situations where time dependence is stronger than space dependence, it's going to be dominated by the minus sign. And indeed, if you could just flip back to the previous slide, slide number 11, you see that Cedric, the determination that Cedric and I got for what the non-local reconstruction or what the non-local distortion function is, just determines it for negative f of x, not for positive f of x, and that's because x is negative for cosmologically interesting situations. In a gravitationally bound system, they don't have to be static, so they may have some time dependence, but it's typically true that the space dependence is going to be stronger than the time dependence, and that means that you'll be dealing with the other sign, that x will be positive. So typically, 1 over box r is negative for cosmology and positive for gravitationally bound systems. And that means that if you want to get perfect screening, not approximate screening, good to within blah, 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 but perfect, 100% screening, you just take the curve that Cedric and I found anyway, which vanishes at x equals 0, and you just extend it for x equals 0. When we pointed that out last summer, when Stanley Deser and I pointed that out last summer, that induced sort of paroxysms of befuddlement and consternation in the F of R crowd. And they said, this is exquisite fine-tuning because you're using a non-analytic function, and how dare you do this thing? Well, first, it's our model. We get to invent it however we want. Secondly, in the context, again, of where we think this is coming from, as the effective field equations of infrared gravitons that were created during inflation, it's totally natural. These things are cosmological scale. They shouldn't have any effect on very, very small scales. This is not exquisite fine-tuning. It's just exactly what you would expect if the thing that Nick and I believe is not moonshine. So anyway, whether there's a good justification for it or not, there's an utterly trivial way to get perfect screening. So there are no solar system deviations. There are no deviations in any gravitationally bound system.
Can we have a question?
Sure.
Is there any new degrees of freedom in this model? Or I can't see. It's not trivial for me. Like, do you get scalar degrees of freedom here? Or?
Could somebody repeat your question? I'm only hearing it chopped up.
Yeah, the question is, are there any new degrees of freedom? So if you get any scalar degrees of freedom in your model?
Oh, excellent question. I'll answer that in about 3 slides. So the answer is no, but I'll answer that very shortly.
Okay.
So it's a great question, and I will answer it, I promise. And the answer is no, there aren't any. Okay, so we're now ready to go to slide 13, which is labeled "The local version is haunted." And that actually bears on the question that was just asked. So very shortly after Deser and I proposed this model, Nogiri and Odinsov came up with a variation of it in which they didn't have any non-locality, but they just had 2 scalars. So the idea is to take our non-local distortion function and replace f of 1 over box r with f of a fundamental scalar phi, and then add a term, a Lagrange multiplier term with a new scalar, xi, multiplying box phi minus r, and then variation of xi with respect, variation with respect to xi enforces that phi is equal to 1 over box r. I think the 1 over box didn't show up on that, but it should be phi is equal to 1 over box r, and you see how you at least naively get back to the original model. You're, of course, not getting back to the original model because both of these scalars, that 1 over box is not R1 over box, which was defined with retarded boundary conditions, but it's 1 over box with arbitrary homogeneous solutions. And so both scalars actually have 2 pieces of initial value data. So there's 2 scalar degrees of freedom in this localized version. And an important point, which was pointed out to me a long time ago by Gilles Esposito-Ferriz, is that one of these extra scalar degrees of freedom is a ghost. To see this with non-dynamical gravity is very, very simple. Just take the kinetic term, the xi box phi term, integrate it by parts, and then decompose that into xi plus phi and xi minus phi. With my space-like metric, you can see that the second term, the xi minus phi, has a negative kinetic energy. That means it's just virulently unstable. Kinetic instabilities are so terrible that the universe doesn't even have a well-defined lifetime. You might object and say that this was done with non-dynamical gravity, and what about the possibility that some of the derivatives in the R F of phi term might mix with the fields to try and prevent that instability? First, let me point out that even if that did occur, it still wouldn't be phenomenologically acceptable because it would mean that xi minus phi got to develop huge inhomogeneities before gravity stabilized it. So that would not be a phenomenologically viable solution to the problem. But secondly, that was analyzed by, Sasaki and a number of other authors. I forgot all of them. I'm sorry. And even though they concluded that that it was stabilized, or at least that it could be stable if you started from specific initial value data, their analysis actually shows that it isn't stable. Because in a theory where the fees are arbitrary, you don't get to pick the initial value data. They can be anything, and there is certainly a huge instability region. So this theory is haunted. It has a kinetic energy instability. So we're ready to go to the next slide, slide 14, which deals with the question that was asked before this slide, which is, are there new scalar degrees of freedom in this model? In the original non-local model that Stanley Deser and I proposed. And the answer is there aren't. The easiest way to see that is to go to a synchronous gauge. So the invariant element will be minus dt squared plus hij of t and x, dx I, dxj, and I've absorbed hij includes the scale factor and everything. It's not the graviton field, it's the full three metric. And the initial value data in general relativity would, as the loop quantum gravity people know better than I, are hij and hij dot, and that's 6 plus 6 degrees of freedom. 4 plus 4 of them are constrained fields. 2 plus 2 of them are dynamical degrees of freedom, usually thought of as gravitons. In non-local cosmology, if you want to count the initial value data, just look at the d by dt's, okay? So R has two time derivatives in it, but 1 over box has sort of an inverse time derivative, and that means that, morally speaking, 1 over box R is just a wash. You can make that analytic, and you can actually just write R is equal to something with no derivatives in it plus things which are shielded by the non-local operator and then have lower than second time derivatives on them. So in fact, the initial value data for this model are exactly the same as they are for general relativity, just hij and hij dot. You can wonder about what's the distribution of them. So remember, in general relativity, 4 plus 4 of them are constrained fields and 2 plus 2 of them are dynamical. We're now ready to go to slide 15, which is that the initial value constraints are just identical to those of general relativity. So recall the effective field equations. They're g mu nu, the regular Einstein tensor, plus our non-local addition, delta g mu nu. And I've given delta g mu nu down below. If we're dealing with retarded boundary conditions, then remember that both 1 over box and d by dt of 1 over box vanish at t equals 0. And remember also that the reconstruction that Cedric and I got has the property that f of x vanishes at x equals 0, which, and x also is equal to 0 at x equals 0. So, in fact, the only terms that are going to be non-zero at x equals zero are the terms involving second time derivatives. So the only part, if you want to just look at the initial value constraints, the only part that you need to look at is g mu nu box minus d mu d nu. If you're interested in looking at the constraint equations, you only need to look at delta g zero zero and delta g zero I. I think most of you already are good enough with general relativity that you can see that those particular combinations don't involve any second time derivatives. Remember, they would have to involve second time derivatives in order to unshield the 1 over box R. So, in fact, those terms all just vanish at t equals 0. The constraints of this non-local cosmology model are exactly the same as those of general relativity. So not only is the initial value data the same as that of general relativity, its distribution into constraints and dynamical fields is the same as general relativity.
Richard?
We're now ready to go to slide 16. Question?
Maybe I stopped paying attention for a second, but when you say at t equals zero, do you really mean that particular value of t at which you sort of start your non-local theory?
Yes. Yes,
so,
I really mean that
so
value.
So if we look at the constraints at some other time, they'll be different?
Yes, in principle they would be.
Okay.
So there is, this model isn't general relativity. It does evolve. And in fact, I'm going to consider what it looks like a little bit later in time on the next slide. But it isn't general relativity, and the constraints aren't zero a little bit later. And that's, of course, right. If the dynamics is different from general relativity, then the constraints would have to be different than general relativity. Otherwise, you see the problem. Okay, so let's go to slide 16, which is dealing with ghosts. And you might think, gosh, how do I even check ghosts since I don't have any energy? I don't, my action is not local. Turns out to be really easy to do it in these kinds of theories. You just look at the second derivative term and you ask whether or not the second derivative terms ever change sign from those of general relativity. That will tell you whether or not you've got a ghost. And so let's just do that. And I've rewritten the equations again for your benefit. The dynamical equations, just as in general relativity, are the IJ equations. We're now going to look at these things not just at t equals zero, but at all times. But we're going to look at second derivative terms. And remember that whereas r has some second derivatives, 1 over box r is morally speaking zeroth derivative. That is, all the derivatives in r are shielded by inverse differential operators. They're all safely in the past. In order to uncover those, in order to get a second derivative term, you have to have at least two derivatives acting on the 1 over box r in order to uncover that. So again, the terms that you need to look at are the g mu nu box minus d mu d nu. And you also get some term coming from the f of x and the 1 over box r f prime of x, because now those are no longer zero because you're away from t equals zero. Rij contains two kinds of terms. The curvatures, the various curvatures, contain two kinds of terms. They contain hij dot, which of course has second derivatives. R has second derivatives, but only in a constrained piece of hij. So those parts are not relevant. So when you put it all together, the dynamical field equations, the part of them that involves second time derivatives, is got the coefficient 1/2 times 1, the general relativistic version, plus f of x plus 1 over box r f prime of x. So it does change, and it does get close to vanishing. Vanishing, remember, would be a ghost, or becoming negative would be a ghost. But it doesn't, in fact, vanish, and that means that no graviton ever becomes a ghost. Of course, this theory still might have a potential energy instability. I've just checked for kinetic energy instabilities. Checking for potential energy instabilities is very, very complicated. You're talking about proofs that are hundreds of pages long, like the Shonan-Yao proof, and we didn't bother checking that, and I don't know the answer about whether or not there's a potential energy instability. So I'm now ready to go to slide 17. Sure.
John, so if you do a Dirac first and second class constraint analysis on Hamiltonian, you will find that there are no negative energy contributions. There are no ghosts.
What Hamiltonian?
If you do a first and second class Dirac constraint analysis.
You know something that I don't know. What Hamiltonian? How do you get a Hamiltonian for this theory?
From the Lagrangian.
Well, it's not a local Lagrangian. How do you get a Hamiltonian for this theory? So I see how to set up an initial value formalism for this theory. I don't really know what a Hamiltonian for it would be.
This is where you do it local.
Yeah, if it was local, I would know what to do. But for this theory, I don't know how to do that.
You don't have a canonical Hamiltonian formula.
Nope, nothing like that. do have an initial value formalism. So we do know what the initial value formalism is, but how to set it up canonically, no, I don't know how to do that. Is that okay?
I see.
Can I move on?
That's it.
John, can I move on?
Please do.
Okay. So far I've been telling you about good things about the model. The model does have a terrible problem, and let me spend the remaining time talking about that. So we're ready now for slide 17, which is a problem with how the model reproduces lambda CDM without lambda. So let's go back to homogeneous and isotropic and assume also that the Hubble parameter is only slowly varying. And remember, the data is telling us that the Hubble parameter is approaching a constant. Well, in that for that kind of situation, then it turns out that all those derivative terms are very, very small. Anything with a derivative is going to be small because it'll be taking derivatives of the slowly varying thing. And then it turns out that that the only part of the effective field equations that's big, it breaks up into a big part and a small part. It needs both to be conserved, but if you just look at the big part is just G mu nu times those factors that I've given. So it isn't general relativity, but it is proportional to general relativity. And of course, any idiot looking like that would say, oh gosh, what I ought to do then is just take the term in curly brackets and I ought to divide both sides of the equations by it and write that then as general relativity is equal to an effective Newton constant. And then you can see how it is that the model is achieving cosmic acceleration with only matter energy density. So the Friedman equation, the reason one would introduce normally vacuum energy is because the Friedman equation, the left-hand side of it, the 3h squared part of it, is going to a constant. That's what the data says. And if you don't have a cosmological constant, then the right-hand side is falling off like 1 over a to the third, and how can you possibly get those two to balance? That's why one would introduce some kind of energy density which is approaching a constant. What non-local cosmology does, and also what most F of R models do, is they resolve this by having this effective Newton constant grow. In other words, they have the 1 plus F of X plus 1 over box R F prime go to 0 so that G is, or get close to 0, so that G effective is growing. And that balances the fall off of the energy density. So that's how they resolve the conundrum of the Friedman equation. But as soon as you see that, you see that that's pretty bad because that also is going to strengthen the force of gravity, and that's a bad thing in general. Your first thought is that, this is already ruled out by the solar system. But remember, that's not true. This derivation that I went through, or this sketchy derivation that I went through, is only valid for a slowly varying h of t, that is homogeneous, isotropic, and slowly varying h of t. Solar system is gravitationally bound, and in fact, there are no deviations inside the solar system. So it's not that the solar system constraints get us. You have to go to something which is a perturbation on the cosmological solution, which is where you're going to be able to see this thing. And that should increase early structure formation. And that was looked at by Scott Donaldson and So-Yun Park and in two papers, one in 2012 and one at the end of 2013. And they analyzed what non-local cosmology does for structure formation, and they showed that it's very bad. So we're ready to go now to the next slide, which is labeled What Donaldson and Park Did. I can see I'm a little bit short on time, so I think I will skip most of this statement. It's too bad because they did a very interesting and careful analysis, but I think I want to get really to their conclusions. So let me just say that they considered scalar plane wave perturbations. So the idea is they take the cosmological background and they add two scalar degrees of freedom to it, one in the G00 component, which is called capital Psi of t in Scott's notation, and the other to the Gij component, which is called capital Phi in Scott's notation. Both of them are spatial plane waves, and they only work to first order in perturbation theory, of course, because this is all for very, very weak structure formation. They consider the stress energy to be made out of just non-relativistic matter, and that means that the two non-trivial Einstein equations are delta G00, which is given there, delta Gij, and you might think, gosh, there's only two equations and there's three variables, how can you possibly solve everything? But I think most everybody's gone through this before, and you see that Gij, the Gij equation, actually has two independent tensor components, one proportional to Kij, Ki, Kj, and the other proportional to delta Ij. So in fact, you get three equations and three unknowns, that's how they do it. I think I will skip how it is that they took the variation of delta x, although that is some very interesting technical stuff about how they did that. So we're ready to go to the next slide, slide 19, which is what Donaldson and Park found. And what they found is, remember, there are these two potentials that they're considering, these two scalar potentials, psi, which is basically the Newtonian potential, and phi, which is its relativistic doppelganger. Phi, they found, non-local cosmology doesn't change much from general relativity, so not much change in that, a little bit, but not much. Psi is the one that really changes, so starting at about z equals 1.5, it grows, and by the time of today, z equals zero, it's reached about twice the value of general relativity. I might remark in passing that that's what you expect coming from this physical understanding of how it is that the model is achieving late-time acceleration by strengthening the force of gravity. It should be making the Newtonian potential bigger, and it is making the Newtonian potential bigger. They then went on, after getting that result, to show that that's already ruled out by the data. There are two classes of data sets that are relevant, one which measures redshift space distortions, and one which measures another set of them that measure weak lensing. Both of them are just devastating for non-local cosmology. If you characterize it, does the data support, or if you give the statistics only the choice between general relativity and non-local cosmology, redshift space distortions favor general relativity over non-local cosmology by a whopping 7.8 sigma. And weak lensing is only slightly less bad, 5.9 sigma. So, you know, on the basis of that, I'm a particle theorist, or at least I was trained as a particle theorist, and our union contract requires us to tell lies and to just obfuscate and ignore bad data and everything, but I'm not going to do that. This model is dead on the basis of that data. I would like to point out something, which was actually pointed out by Donaldson and Park, and that is that although the data very, very heavily favors general relativity over non-local cosmology, it doesn't work that well for general relativity either. So let's look at the next slide, which is the data points of those two data sets. So the first one is showing the weak lensing data, and the one on the right-hand side is showing the redshift space distortion data. And, I have that backwards. You can see that, so the dashed lines are non-local cosmology, and the solid lines are general relativity. So general relativity does do a better job of matching the data than non-local cosmology, but in fact, almost every data point is below both models. And you could actually be quantitative about that because Donaldson and Park were kind enough to send us an early version of their paper in which they had made a sign error. So they thought that non-local cosmology was operating the other sense. And then you were getting the result that general relativity was disfavored by about three sigma or so, more than three sigma sometimes. So in fact, it's not not what a particle theorist would or particle experimentalist would call a detection yet, but it's at least evidence that there's some tension between the data and general relativity. And that's interesting for trying to build better models because there's what Weinberg might refer to as a folk theorem. By the way, I'm ready to go to slide 21 now, my penultimate slide. There's what Weinberg might refer to as a folk theorem, you know, a piece of common wisdom that's never formally stated or proved anywhere, which is that if you can get close with one parameter, then you can nail the sucker with two. And in particular, it seems to me that rather than being depressed about this, the Donaldson-Park paper is actually very, well, it's certainly, whether I'm depressed or not, it's certainly great work, and that it's actually, in a certain sense, good news and a clear indication of what types of models one should try and build. So I'd like to, in this last slide, consider going beyond the simple sort of model that Stanley Deser and I thought of, which is where we change the Lagrangian by a term of the form R f of x. And way, way, way back when Cedric and I were doing the reconstruction, it first occurred to me how these models were achieving late-time acceleration. And I became uninterested in them after that because I could see that they were achieving late-time acceleration by strengthening the effective Newton constant. And I could foresee that that was going to give problems with structure formation, as Park and Donaldson have in fact shown. And I became interested with Nick Tsamis in creating a different set of models. What we'd really like is something which is instead of introducing an effective time-dependent Newton constant, would be something which is introducing an effective time-dependent cosmological constant. And I became interested in how to do that with Nick Tsamis, and we wrote a paper in 2009 about how to do that. The paper, well, I think I'm sort of running on empty as far as time goes, so let me not say too many details, but we did create a model that does that. Our idea was to have it evolve from primordial inflation and have this represent what we believe is the quantum gravitational back reaction on inflation. And we found that that for a huge class of models, basically any f of z which increases without bounds, starting from f of z equals z, going all the way to f of z equals e to the z, the universe will inflate for a long period of time and then eventually stop. And further, it'll relax into a radiation-dominated universe in which the effective stress energy becomes quiescent. And that's all because it's acting on 1 over box is acting on R, and R just vanishes in radiation domination. So we were really buoyed up by this, but a little bit later, 1 year later, we looked at what happens when matter domination occurs. And of course, R then changes from being zero to being non-zero. And that's a disaster for this class of models because remember, the growth of 1 over box R, or the negative growth of 1 over box R, is driving screening for these models. And 1 over box R grows the same way in matter domination as it does in primordial inflation, and that means that it would lead to further screening rather than acceleration, which is what the data is favoring. Tsamis and I found a way of changing that, and that is to take this class of models, which involve a function capital F of minus g lambda times 1 over box r, and change that lambda from being a constant to being a dynamical curvature, which is u mu u nu r mu nu. And that dynamical curvature is chosen so that it changes sign, so that it, for a homogeneous and isotropic geometry, it's just R00. And that changes sign from primordial inflation, in which it would be minus 3h squared, to matter domination, in which it would be plus 3 halves h squared. And that, that actually avoids the conundrum that we were having of this disaster of what happens with the turn on to matter domination, and introduces this other non-local invariant. And I have played around a lot with non-local effective field theory, also with Cedric Defayet and Gilles Esposito-Ferriz, in an attempt not to talk about cosmology, but rather to get a non-local gravity or metric-based version of gravity that reproduced Milgram's modified Newtonian dynamics, so reproduces the Tully-Fisher relation, but with enough lensing to be consistent, with enough weak lensing to be consistent with data. And we also found that you need another invariant. 1 over box R is not enough to do it. You need this other invariant, U mu, U nu, R mu nu. So there are sort of 3 separate threads that are all pointing towards another invariant, the need for another invariant. And I feel pretty strongly that since you can already get close, you can get the expansion history and you can get structure formation, albeit you know, bad kind of structure formation. Since you can get close with one parameter, I think that if you introduced another non-local invariant, you would probably be able to not only be consistent with the data, but to do a better job of matching the data than general relativity. And so that actually encourages me, and I'm going to try and build models that do that. So I'm out of time now, and that's good because I'm done too. Let's just flip to the final slide, which is conclusions. Let me just remind you that the non-local gravity theories that I've been considering, I don't think are fundamental. You're free to regard them just as model building, but in my heart of hearts, I believe that they come from being the effective field equations of quantum gravitational corrections from primordial inflation. The simplest model is the one that Deser and I considered based on R, F of 1 over box R. That is good as far as explaining the cosmic coincidence problem because it's got 2 built-in delays coming from the fact that R vanishes during radiation domination, so it doesn't even turn on until the matter domination transition, and even then it only turns on slowly because it's reflected through a non-local operator. And the simple model can definitely reproduce lambda CDM without lambda. But structure formation, as Donaldson and Park in excellent work showed, very, very heavily favors general relativity. I've just argued to you that other threads are pointing us in the need to introduce another invariant. And there is sort of a folk theorem in physics that if you can get close with one parameter, if you introduce another parameter, you can nail it. And I think I feel actually pretty confident that one can cook up a model with this other invariant, which will actually do a better job than general relativity does of reproducing structure formation. And since the other invariant is still very, very close to the one that I've been considering, I think it will have the same desirable properties that this model has. Namely, perfect screening for gravitationally bound system, no new degrees of freedom, initial value constraints identical to general relativity, and no kinetic energy instabilities. And I'll stop there and thank you all for your attention. Could you get closer to the microphone, John? I'm getting your question chopped up, and I can't parse it. Good to see you again, by the way.
In a work from a long time ago, on non-local quantum field theory, the theory was carefully constructed so that the tree graphs, the classical tree graphs, were strictly local.
Yes, I remember coming up with the way to do that.
Yeah. And
or Gary Kleppe.
Yeah, and gauge invariance, unitary, all of that was concerned, finiteness of loops. So, if you, what happens if you quantize this Lagrangian you have with Stanley and yourself? Is it feasible?
I wouldn't even hazard to guess. We definitely don't think of that as a quantum Lagrangian. We think of that as you know, an effective action. So I wouldn't. I've never even investigated that, and I would be reluctant to take that very seriously. So I am definitely not suggesting that fundamental theory is non-local, although, you know, one has to keep an open mind about things. But at least for this talk and for most of my work, I'm not not suggesting that fundamental theory is non-local.
And in your non-local mind.
Yes.
What the problem with mind is, first of all, is it's not relativistic, but it's also it does not.
Yes, you're right. That's why people have been trying to make relativistic extensions of it. But you're right. The original version of it's not relativistic.
The mind of Wittgenstein does not fit galaxy clusters. Significant dark matter. Also,
it's true, cluster cores need more dark matter.
And it doesn't fit the CMB data, in particular the angular power spectrum and the matter power spectrum. So
well, that might be true for Bekenstein's Tevye's theory. I don't think you can say that that's true for any relativistic generalization of Mond.
Well, Bekenstein's theory is arranged to give Mond at the weak field.
Sure. So, but that just means that one relativistic generalization of Mond doesn't do a good job of fitting the CMB data. But I think it's entirely possible that there's another relativistic generalization of it, or at least if there's a no-go theorem about that, I don't know what the no-go theorem would be.
My relativistic version without dark matter, it does fit the CMB and galaxy clusters without, and the galaxies very well without dark matter, but it requires more work, particular structure formation.
Thank you. Okay, thank you.